Hebrews 8, Hebrews 9 is where we're at. And it says that there was a tabernacle made. Ninth chapter, second verse. The first is spelled out because there's another tabernacle being built, and we're a part of it. The ninth verse of the chapter says the first tabernacle was a figure for the time then present. Verse 11, but Christ being come and high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands. And without finishing the phrase, we've taken that as our jumping off point and have spent many weeks looking at the tabernacle and seeing Jesus in every fabric and every element. Simply stated, God tabernacled in the midst of his people, and as long as they would not deviate in every jot and tittle of the plan and pattern given to Moses was carried out, man had access to God, from whose presence man had been driven. God wrote all the terms. He's a covenant-making God, and this is an Old and New Testament. The words in the original language more precise even than ours, that it's a one-sided kind of contract and geographically separated from God. If you wanted access, you had to come his way through the tribe of Judah. Jesus was of that tribe, through the one door, the four colors of which, blue, purple, white, and red, spoke of Jesus, to the altar of burnt offering where a sacrifice was offered, to a laver of cleansing, to an inner enclosed area of two compartments, the holy place, wherein was a tabernacle, where was a candlestick, a table of showbread, and an altar of incense. And in the Holy of Holies, the Ark of the Covenant, over which dwelt the Shekinah glory. A glory, as we've pointed out many times, is God's presence manifested on earth. The Shekinah glory, they called it, and it was seen or viewed as light. And the high priest, representing the people, once a year could part the curtain on the great day of atonement and go in and stand before God and present all the people's needs to God once a year, and sacrifices availed for a year. Those were the terms. And the tabernacle was built for the ark. And as we've said many times, the ark, God painted the pictures until a child can figure it out. Black acacia wood, symbolizing the root out of a dry ground, which Jesus was to become when he assumed our humanity. Covered with gold, which through the tabernacle symbolizes divinity. Inside, the unbroken tablets of stone. The first tablets of stone containing the Ten Commandments were broken. The ones that were not broken were to be kept inside the ark. Only he kept them. The high priest's rod, that through a long night, that dead rod turned to life and budded. When the high priest anointing was challenged, and Aaron's rod as a type of death and resurrection was kept in there, also to tell us it was Christ to be seen in the ark, and the golden censer with the manna inside, the golden pot of manna, the living bread that had come down from God out of heaven symbolized. He kept the law. He was the resurrection and the life. He was the bread of life in this Ark of the Covenant, that we might know Jesus was symbolized. Having looked at most of the elements of the tabernacle in some detail, we've been journeying with the Ark. Because where the Ark went, Jesus is being typified in his relationship with his people as they journey. And we can learn how to relate to Jesus on our journey as we study these journeyings of the ark. We've looked at two in some detail. We saw, as Moses was leading God's people through the wilderness, he almost made the mistake of relying on human eyesight. And he wanted someone to go along as a guide who knew the country, and his eyes would be eyes for them. The ark broke the pattern and went ahead 3 days to find a place of rest. And we learned the lessons of getting ahead of God. We also looked at the happenings at Kadesh Barnea, where in less than 3 years' journey out of Egypt, God's people were only 11 days' journey from the promised land. 11 days away from all that God had promised them. But they waited one day too late. They looked at the giants instead of God, and in fear they said, "We can't do it." God got fed up, and he said, "Okay, you're going to wander the balance of the years to consume 40 years, 1 year for every day you spied out the land. I'm going to throw your carcasses in the wilderness, and everybody over 20 years of age is going to die, and you won't make it in." Well, that scared the liver out of them. Now they were more scared of God than the giants. They said, "We're going to go in." One day too late, Moses says, "The ark won't go with you." And they were beaten up terribly. So we learned you not only can get ahead of the ark, you can fall too slow behind it. You got to stay in a continual relationship with Jesus. Don't move ahead of him, and don't wait too long when it's time to move. Now, I'm not teaching those lessons over tonight. I'm just briefly summarizing so that we see that this ark teaches profound meanings tonight. The problem's not going ahead of him. That was the first lesson we learned. Don't go ahead of him. And don't wait too late behind him. Now we're going to see what happens when you get totally out of tune. When you substitute the form for reality. This was a symbol of God's presence. But the ark by itself became the mercy seat, became the meeting place on that gold slab that covered it. The Shekinah glory would come down, and God's presence would dwell there over the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. The ark by itself symbolized Jesus. The Shekinah glory made reality out of the symbols. I want you to go into 1 Samuel, and let me tell you a history of another section of journeys and relationships with the ark tonight. And has been the case in the other two lessons. Take spiritual ears to tune in. Eli had become the priest. Much time had passed. The promised land has been taken. The ark was carried across Jordan's River. The ark was carried around the city of Jericho. The ark was carried to the place where Nablus now sits in modern Israel, and between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. The blessings and the curses were reiterated. God's people gathered around the ark. So I'm well down in the history now. They have taken the promised land. They've been dwelling in it. And Eli became the priest. His sons became rascals, second to none. I don't even want to take the time to read some of the things they did. But the abominations that the sons of Eli did, you wouldn't believe. The second generation of this priesthood. Apparently Eli was a good man. He just didn't have the backbone to take care of his own kids. And they took advantage of him. The tragedy, there are a lot of preachers that have had to deal with that pain. A lot of leaders, and not just preachers, a lot of churches. The second generation growing up in the church needs to pay close attention to the sons of Eli. Their familiarity with the things of God bred contempt. And as one has said, God has no grandchildren. You may want your kids to be raised in the church, but don't overdo it. Far better for them to learn to respect the things of God than to keep them there at any cost. Some people wonder why I come down so hard on respect for the king and the king's house. I've been a student of revival movements. I've seen the deterioration of second and third generation. The parents come to God out of sin. They know God's reality. They know the emptiness of sin. And they meet God's reality first. And then with all good intentions, you want to raise your kids in the church. Any price to keep them in the church. That's where their talent's going to be displayed. That's where they will have opportunity of outlet. That's where their social activities will go on, and there are a lot of what I call goony bird parents running around. I've called a lot of other things goony birds. Might as well do this too. But think, as long as your kids are in church or a church youth meeting, they're all right. This preacher's kid will tell you. I don't know how blunt I can be with you. If you want to learn how to sin, go to Bible school. Well, all you ex-Bible school ones, where are you? Let me see. How many of you know I'm telling you the truth? These second, third generation, particularly the holiness movements and the Pentecostal movements, if there's anybody that knows how to put on the act in front of the parents, it's Pentecostal kids. I know I'm shocking some of you, but it's true. That takes nothing away from the genuine. If you want to find, on an average, disorderly churches, you go to the revival movement churches. I became, I might as well name, no I'm not. My first assignment out of Stanford University was at a headquarters church of a major denomination. That's where the kids of the executives went to church, the teachers in the Bible school, the missions department, the publishing house. Well, it was a blackboard jungle. The son of the treasurer of the movement threw pepper in the eyes of the girls on the Sunday school bus. teenagers locked out. One of the teenage boys' class locked the teacher out. No, they locked him in the class. That was it. Wouldn't let him out. Things that went on, I had strangers come to the church that told me of vulgarities passed while the service was going on in the wing that you wouldn't believe. I got my battle scars early. That was the headquarters church. I was there the third Sunday when I declared war and said, we don't have a discipline problem in this church anymore. One more move and you're gone. Your dad's the superintendent. That's it. I went to that classroom, locked the door. I learned a long time ago the danger of familiarity with the things of God. This is the King's house. I've had some say, well, can't you be more gentle? Yeah. When some of the parents start licking the tar out of the kids I have to bawl out when they get home because they got a bawling out, then I don't have to be hard anymore. You read about the sons of Eli. God does not want followers at any cost, including your children. And if there's one single reason I'm a preacher today, I learned to respect God's house, God's ministers, and God's word. And that's more important than learn a lot of little goody-goody stories. Because when the time comes that you need it, you'll be there. That's not the lesson tonight. I threw all that in free. The sons of Eli treated the things of God with such commonality you wouldn't believe without reading it what they did. God always has somebody on the scene. Third chapter of 1 Samuel. The child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli, and the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. I could preach on that, you know. It was precious because it was hard to get. It came to pass at that time when Eli was laid down in his place and his eyes began to wax dim. The King James is not very good there. It softens it. He went blind. And ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was, and Samuel was laid down to sleep, that the Lord called Samuel, and he answered, here am I. He went to Eli, and Eli said, no, I didn't. He said, what, did you call me Eli? He said, no, I didn't. Go back to sleep. Second time he heard a voice, went to Eli. Eli said, no, I didn't call you. Go back to sleep. Third time, then Eli, who I guess had gotten so out of the habit of God talking, it took three trips for him to figure it out. He says, that's the Lord. Next time you hear the voice, respond. The boy went back. God called him. And then God gave to Samuel a vision of destruction that was going to come upon Eli's house and all of God's people. The leadership had gone bad. The people had gone bad. Important to see that. The people were bad at Kadesh Barnea. But Moses was in tune. Joshua and Caleb were in tune. And Moses was able to tell them about the ark, and the ark stayed where Moses was, and they went in and got defeated, as we saw in the last lesson. But now both the leaders and the people have gone bad. The people are worshiping idols, worshiping Baal. the priesthood, which acted also as judge during these days, because remember, as Samuel gets old and is about to die, the people say, because his sons weren't so hot either, they say, your children aren't going straight and you're going to die, so give us a king so we can be like other nations. So they didn't yet have a king. Samuel was just a boy. Eli, blind and old, and his two sons occupying the temple, the temporary structure awaiting the great temple that Solomon would build, and they were ministering to the people, both of them bad, the people and the leaders. God tells Samuel a destruction that's going to fall. Samuel didn't want to tell Eli for fear of hurting him, but Eli said, tell me. So Samuel told him every whit, hid nothing from him, the 18th verse said. And he said, it is the Lord, it is the Lord, let him do what seemeth him good. Samuel grew and the Lord was with him. And I just get frustrated in these chapters because I'm running by about 15 messages. Samuel grew, the Lord was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. Isn't it interesting? He didn't run up any signs. He didn't say, I'm a prophet. But everybody knew it. Now, if you're a real prophet, you don't have to announce it. I had a fellow call me up in Orville, remember? He introduced himself. He said, I'm a Pentecostal prophet. I want to talk to you. I said, I've heard all I want. If you have to announce yourself, it isn't worth listening to. If you're a real prophet, you don't have to beat a drum about it. Everybody that listens to you will know it. Says he did let none of his words fall to the ground. He spoke it as the Lord gave it to him, but he didn't say, I'm a prophet. He just prophesied. You know what the word prophecy comes from? And prophet, it's a root word that means to boil. And the prophet is a forth teller, not just one who sees the future, one who tells forth what God has put in him, and it's boiling and it comes out. Now just remember, the spirit of the prophet subject to the prophet, lest somebody wants to go wild all of a sudden. But when the prophet does speak, you know the difference. I've said for years, if full gospel people trust the discernment, they could get by all right. How many times you heard somebody spout off and it gives you chills? Not the kind of goosebump good chills, you know, God speaking, just gives you an eerie feeling. And you go home, you beat yourself over the head because you think you shouldn't be critical. Go ahead and just trust your judgment. Because when it's really God, I've noticed even the outsiders feel good about it. And most of you know I'm telling you the truth. You can tell when it's got a ring to it. But you let God begin to move, in'll come some stranger that's always hunting for a crowd to prophesy to that God's created. The minute revival starts, I start alerting all my ushers. You watch him. There's some strange bird comes in. Get him, get ready. He's going to let off. There are no strangers going to prophesy here. And that's for television, in case they do come. There's enough of God's people here alive in the Spirit whose lives we can judge. We don't need any help from a stranger. Come prove yourself, and then we'll listen to you. I don't know how I get on all this, but it's there. All Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again in Shiloh. That's where the ark had come to rest, in Shiloh. And the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle and pitched beside Ebenezer. Ebenezer. How many have ever heard that word before? Ebenezer. I want you to notice the difference. 1 Samuel 4, it doesn't say much about. Most of you won't even have in the margin of your Bible a meaning for that word Ebenezer. Because God's people are going to take a real licking. They're going to get beat up bad. Over in 1 Samuel 7, in the same place, they win a tremendous victory. Then Samuel, verse 12, chapter 7, took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shin, and called the name of it Ebenezer. How many of you got in the margin, the translation, the stone of help? Why didn't they say that back here? Because it didn't help nobody. But over in the seventh chapter, same place, same valley, same conflict, some of the same people that had fought in the previous battle. Previous time, God's people got beat up bad, but now God's people win a great victory. And Samuel took a stone, called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, that is, he called it the stone of help, saying, hitherto hath the Lord helped us. They even had something else in chapter 4. Let me just tell the story, because I got to go all the way to 2 Samuel chapter 6. That's a long ways to go tonight, isn't it? So let me tell the story. I'm going to skip a little for you that just panicked. The Philistines put themselves in array. Israel went out to battle the Philistines and pitch beside Ebenezer. I'm in chapter 4, 1 Samuel, first verse. And the Philistines pitched in Aphek. The Philistines put themselves in array against Israel, and when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines. They slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. And when the people were come into the camp, the elders of Israel said, oh, no, I'm really fighting, not camping on these verses. The board decided they'd take over. The elders. Where was Eli? Where was Samuel? They ain't there. The elders had it all figured out, refined. This is a big shot elder fellowship of the Old Testament. They had a meeting. All you have to do is get the right elements together and God can work the same. You see, I'm old-fashioned. Every saint of God in Ephesians is made to sit in heavenly places. Every saint of God is a saint that's become the habitation of God through His Spirit. God hath blessed all of us. And you become a saint the minute you give yourself to God. God gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the perfecting of the saints. Now I know that the present revival homogenizes everything. I also know I can find you 10 million crooked preachers probably in history that have taken advantage of authority. Just as I can find priests and kings in the Old Testament. But God doesn't change. Get the right mix of the ingredients that He wants, and things happen. Don't try to change the mix. Just straighten up your part of the mix. But God's still a God of order, a God of authority, a God of leadership. There is no separation in the New Testament between laity and ministry. We're all in the ministry if we're in the body of Christ. But the Lord places us in the body. And some are a hand, and some are an eye, and some are an ear. Some are a leg, some are a toenail, and some are a eyeball. The Lord places you. There are too many people, I think, volunteering in the New Testament as they ministered to the Lord and fasted. The Holy Ghost said, "Separate unto me Barnabas and Saul for the work whereunto I have called them." But there's a missing ingredient in this board meeting. The people were come into the camp. The elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? What happened? What's changed? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh." No inquiring of the Lord. This would have been equally wrong if Eli and Samuel had been there and not inquired of the Lord. There was no inquiring of the Lord. They just had a committee meeting. You know what I think of committees, don't you? Abraham and Sarah had one, produced Ishmael, thorn in their flesh ever after. They improved upon God's plan. There are a lot of churches across this land need to proclaim a fast and do some fresh praying and less talking. I'm still preaching the same sermon I preached 18 months ago. We still need to march, keep our mouth shut a while until God has delivered us from our problems. They had a committee meeting. The elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines?" Anybody could ask a question like that. You'd not be spiritual. They knew they'd gotten licked. "Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant." Always worked before. Have you ever seen a modern church just talking like this? Something's missing, so let's figure out something we used to do and do it again. "Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh among us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hands of our enemies." They didn't see past the ark to God Himself. There is nothing more finely tooled by God than the ark. The tabernacle was built for the ark. There is nothing that the details were laid out by God any more precisely than the ark. There is nothing that had a history of God's blessing any more than the ark. And yet, shockingly, God's presence is not even going to reveal itself with the ark. I hope I can say this right, because we're on hard truth tonight. And there's a way to say it until the sword will bring life. It'll bring death to some, but it should bring life too. There is a danger that the very sacred emblems and expressions identified with God's presence will become a substitute for God Himself, to where we think a repetition of those things are okay. Let no man be deceived. Saul had long since departed from the center of God's presence, but the gifts of God are without recall. He went down where Samuel and the sons of the prophets were, and he prophesied until people said, "Is Saul a prophet?" This ark, they thought, was the solution. Always had been. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from thence the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims. The Lord of hosts dwells between the cherubims. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. The worst sons of them all. Two of them. The two sons I've talked about. Miserable rascals. They were there with the Ark of the Covenant. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. Can't you see them jumping around? When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the ark of the Lord was come into the camp. I didn't want to come, as you know, to Faith Center. I'm so glad I did. I have no regrets. In fact, each day I recognize more the privilege of being God's instrument. But I took the trouble to find out about Faith Center's greatness. It has been my lot down through the years to be asked by founders of churches that grew up in revival to succeed them. I was present in Kansas City, filled in during crises in Aaron Wilson's declining years at Evangel Temple. I know what he asked me to do. I spent 2 months at Brightmoor Tabernacle in Detroit, where Bon Bowman had said he had prayed for 4 years, and I was the only man God brought before him. And he wanted me to succeed him. It's been my life to study revival movements and to see the substitution of form for reality. To see the tendency to think if we can just duplicate what once was, it'll be the same. No, it won't. It'll never be the same. You must go on. That's what these people learned. The Philistines were afraid. They said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe unto us. For there hath not been such a thing heretofore. Woe unto us! Who shall deliver us out of the hand of these mighty gods?" These are the gods that smote the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Can I put parenthetically something I do ever so often for those students that watch? You know, ever so often there are these little hidden proofs of the veracity of God's book. If this is written by a bunch of phonies, why didn't they make those Philistines say it right? The plagues, you remember, occurred in Egypt. And these Philistines blurted out, because they've gotten the story confused as the years have gone on, and the Philistines are quoted saying, "This God delivered them out of Egypt and put all those plagues in the wilderness." God's book is accurate. That's the end of the parenthesis. If it was written by a bunch of phonies, they could improve those things, you know. They could have had the Philistines tell the story right. Well, they don't have to, because the book tells it right. They quote those dumb Philistines making their error. That means the book's honest. End of parenthesis. Woe unto us! And they viewed that God the way they viewed their god Dagon. There's another god. The god of the Hebrews was Jehovah. The god of Philistines was Dagon. Woe unto us, they said. This god will get us. But then somebody rallies them, says, "Be strong, quit yourselves like men, O ye Philistines, that you be not servants unto the Hebrews as they have been to you. Quit yourselves like men and fight." And the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten. And they fled every man into his tent. They lost 4,000 in the first round. They lost 30,000 this time. With the ark present, they lost 30,000. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli were slain. X them out. A footman runs back to Shiloh. Blind Eli is sitting by the gate on a seat. Guess it didn't have a back on it. The footman comes running out of breath. Dirt on his head is a sign of mourning. Dashes into the town, gives the news. Comes to Eli with the news that the ark has been taken and carried off. Now Eli could bear with the report of the loss of the battle and the loss of his sons. But he sat on the wayside watching. His heart trembled for the ark of God. He knew better. He knew what God had told Samuel. He knew the ark had been taken forth with presumption. He knew that men were treating God's place of presence, God's emblem of his life, as though it was something they could just move around like a pawn for their own benefit. It's hard for me to preach this tonight in front of television and not get more direct than I am. I grieve in today's charismatic world. I believe in the fullness of the Spirit. I preach grace and God's love as much as anybody running loose. But I grieve with the sense that Tozer put in words when I see a loss of a fear of God. When I see the commonality until speaking in tongues becomes a toy to be thrown out on TV and shown off. Why do you think Paul said, "I speak in tongues more than you all"? It'd be superfluous for him to say it. He did it all the time. He said, "I'd rather speak one word understood than a thousand in an unknown tongue." You can impress people when you roll out the emblems of God's presence. And they'll probably be, if they're like some of the Philistines with memory, they'll be awestruck, possibly responding with wonder. But God's not a toy. God's power is a consuming fire as well as a gentle dove. I know it's a gift. God's Spirit is a gift. And you don't have to struggle to get it. But John 2 tells me, many believed on Jesus when they saw the miracles that he did, but he did not commit himself unto them because he knew what was in their heart. There are 1,500 people running around trying to seize Catherine Kuhlman's mantle. Without going through what Catherine Kuhlman went through to get there. It's hard for me not to preach on Elisha following Elijah tonight. The mantle didn't fall on all the sons of the prophets. It fell on the one that kept going until they too stood at Jordan, where another step put him totally on God. And on the other side of Jordan, then the master said, "What will you have from me?" He said, "I want a double portion." And they too went on and talked clear on out into the wilderness. And to my dying day, I'll try to figure out what they talked about. Secret things. You can't twist God's arm with gimmickry. He is. And as I've said, there isn't anybody more gullible than Christians.
Why do you think we hammer at truth? I don't think I have a corner on truth, but Jesus came full of grace and truth. Some people let miracle and speaking in tongues cover everything. Jesus covers everything to those that commit themselves to Him. But get eyes of discernment that the ark by itself, presumed upon, didn't bring the victory. That's the point. Philistines beat him up. Eli got the news. His heart bled for the ark of God. When the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. And when Eli heard the noise of the crying, he said, "What meaneth the noise of this tumult?" And the man came in hastily and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were dim, and he could not see. And the man said unto Eli, "I am he that came out of the army, and I fled today out of the army." And he said, "What is there done, my son?" The messenger answered and said, "Israel is fled before the Philistines. There hath been also a great slaughter among the people, and they and thy two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God is taken." And it came to pass, when he made mention of the ark, give Eli credit for this, he could take the loss, he could even take the loss of his sons. But when he learned what had happened to the ark, he fell from off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck broke, and he died. For he was an old man and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. The wife of one of his sons almost died with childbirth. But she went through it, and she named the child, and here's a name that has come across the history of the church. She named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory is departed from Israel." Ichabod means there is no glory. The glory's gone. The Shekinah glory would dwell no more. And they lost the ark. The Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer unto Ashdod. They took it into their temple where Dagon was. They rose up early the next morning. I want to show you that God hadn't departed. He just departed their presence. Once the point was made that he wasn't going to be a part of their non-God-directed and non-God-committed activity, until the ark was alone by itself, it had more power expressed by it than with all the people. Because they put it into this heathen temple, and when they rose up early in the morning, Dagon was falling down on his face. And anything there but the ark and this Dagon, big old hewn out image, they set it up. I guess they thought it was an accident. Came in next morning, the stupid thing had fallen down, knocked its head off and both its hands off, and all left was a stump. They then got so scared they tried to move the ark of God. You read its history in those chapters. Everywhere they put it, disease and plague came upon them. Death, everywhere it went. Finally, they put it on the ark and said, "Let's just, everything is going so bad, let's put it on an ark with some oxen, young oxen in front of it. And if it heads one direction, we'll know all this misery is just an accident, just chance. But if it heads a certain direction, with those dumb animals pulling it, we'll know that the plague has come upon us because of God." Sure enough, it made a beeline the direction that proved God was doing it. See, there's a difference between manifestation and demonstration. They had plenty of demonstration in that battle with the Philistines. There was no manifestation. And when the ark was by itself, it did more damage to the Philistines than with the whole army trying to make God their instrument. Well, it finally ended up in a field. Plague still followed it. And then they came to Samuel. And Samuel, in that next chapter, the ark was still not with them. You know how long it stayed away? 70 years. But it finally came to rest in Kirjath-Jearim. They fetched the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab. Abinadab in the hill and sanctified Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. It abode there. The children of Israel then listened. It says, read the second verse of chapter 7. It came to pass while the ark abode in Kirjath-Jearim that the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. See the change? They didn't have a committee meeting. The elders didn't decide what to do. All the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. You know why God is saving Faith Center? Some faithful ones hung in there. Some faithful ones hung in there. And you know how the power will take us on as we climb mountains? Staying right with God. This is why ever since I've been here, I've resisted every attempt to get a lot of stuff going. I haven't even got started tonight. We'll end up hauling this ark around on a cart, real fancy, you know. It gets things done in a hurry. That's on down the trip. God's ways never change. God's ways are not our ways. You've never met a preacher in your life that can think up more gimmicks and more plans. I used to be a consultant to 31 of the largest churches in this country. I've got stacks of gimmicks piled away, tried all of them. I know what it's going to take for God to deliver us. And what Faith Center needs is not some massage. They need life. They need power. They need God's presence. Until when you walk in the door, you know it. Not because people pull out all the relics and do the same things they've been doing, but it'll be so real that every sinner that walks in will know it when he walks in the door. You say it isn't here yet? Do something about it then. Start praying. I think I don't know what goes on. I hear it all. You tell the next answer man that comes along with you and tells you what this church needs, get on his knees and talk to God. God's able to strike me dead if I'm the wrong one. There's a way to relate to God. Emotions are not enough. The relics are not enough. He is a holy and a just, a righteous and an unchanging and a powerful God. There is grace, but what they missed was Him. Don't tell me this preacher's kidding. Pentecost don't know what he's talking about. I've grown up in churches where they say, oh, wonderful message, wasn't it? What did he say? I don't know. The way he said it just blessed me. I've preached to a generation that felt if the sermon got interrupted 15 times with somebody spouting off, that was God moving. I want to see the dead raised and sinners shake and lives change. And all the rest go along with it. But it'll be more generated by God's power and less imitated in action. This preacher wants reality. And I know where we get it. When we draw nigh to Him in His book. When we come there that we can line up to that which He has said. If this priest had been doing his job, the people would have been straightened out. Samuel got them straightened out finally, and they had victory. They hearkened. They lamented. lamented. And then what happened? Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel. You mean they had to listen a while? Yeah, some people think that if revival comes, it's all shouting, singing, praying, feeling good. Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, if ye do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods from among you. Prepare your hearts unto the Lord and serve Him only. The message of commitment is the necessary prerequisite to revival. The message of commitment. 100% commitment. There's never been revival without it. Serve Him only, and He will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. Then the children of Israel did put away and serve the Lord only. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you unto the Lord. You see the difference? I'll pray for you unto the Lord. They had a committee meeting earlier. They figured out what needed to be done. He said, I'll pray. They gathered together to Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before the Lord and fasted on that day and said there, we have sinned against the Lord. When the Philistines heard the children of Israel were gathered to Mizpah, they'd already licked them there once. They came up against Israel, and when the children of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And the children of Israel said to Samuel, cease not to cry unto the Lord our God for us, that He will save us out of the hand of the Philistines. And Samuel took a sucking lamb and offered it for a burnt offering holy unto the Lord. I wish I could talk on burnt offering here. And Samuel cried unto the Lord for Israel, and the Lord heard him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. Listen. Well, this is what I'm waiting for, folks. I know what God can do. As they drew near to battle, the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines and discomfited them, and they were smitten before Israel. All the Israelites had to do was chase them. God won the battle, and glory to His name, He will win it here. God transformed the same Ebenezer into the stone of help. No wonder that we have faith in God when we live with Him. The river that was to destroy Moses became the instrument of salvation. God will turn this curse into a blessing. Glory to His name. When we relate to God as He says we must relate to Him, praise His name.